That evening, Strange told Arabella all that Mr. Norrell had said, and all that he, Strange, had said in reply. It was the queerest thing in the world. He was so frightened at having been found out that he could think of nothing to say. It fell to me to think of fresh lies for him to tell me. I was obliged to conspire with him against myself. But I do not understand, said Arabella. Why should he contradict himself in this odd way? Oh, he's determined to keep some things to himself. That much is obvious. And I suppose he cannot always remember what is to be a secret and what is not. You remember that I told you there are gaps among the books in his library? Well, it seems that the very day he accepted me as his pupil, he ordered 5 shelves to be emptied and the books sent back to Yorkshire, because they were too dangerous for me to read. Good Lord, however did you find that out? Asked Arabella, much surprised. Drawlight and Lascelles told me. They took great pleasure in it. Ill-natured wretches. Mr. Norrell was most disappointed to learn that Strange's education must be interrupted for a day or two while he and Arabella sought for a house to live in. It is his wife that is the problem, Mr. Norrell explained to Drawlight with a sigh. Had he been a single man, I dare say he would not have objected to coming and living here with me. Drawlight was most alarmed to hear that Mr. Norrell had entertained such a notion, and in case it were ever revived, he took the precaution of saying, Oh, but sir, think of your work for the Admiralty and the War Office, so important and so confidential. The presence of another person in the house would impede it greatly. Oh, but Mr. Strange is going to help me with that, said Mr. Norrell. It would be very wrong of me to deprive the country of Mr. Strange's talents. Mr. Strange and I went down to the Admiralty last Thursday to wait upon Lord Mulgrave. I believe that Lord Mulgrave was none too pleased at first to see that I brought Mr. Strange. That is because his lordship is accustomed to your superior magic. I dare say he thinks that a mere amateur, however talented, has no business meddling with Admiralty matters. But when his lordship heard Mr. Strange's ideas for defeating the French by magic, he turned to me with a great smile upon his face and said, You and I, Mr. Norrell, had grown stale. We wanted new blood to stir us up, did we not? Lord Mulgrave said that. To you? Said Drawlight. That was abominably rude of him. I hope, sir, that you gave him one of your looks. What? Mr. Norrell was engrossed in his own tale and had no attention to spare for whatever Mr. Drawlight might be saying. Oh, I said to him, I am quite of your mind, my lord, but only wait until you have heard the rest of what Mr. Strange has to say. You have not heard the half of it. It was not only the Admiralty. The War Office and all the other departments of government had reason to rejoice at the advent of Jonathan Strange. Suddenly a good many things which had been difficult before were made easy. The King's ministers had long treasured a plan to send the enemies of Britain bad dreams. The Foreign Secretary had first proposed it in January 1808, and for over a year Mr. Norrell had industriously sent the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte a bad dream each night, as a result of which nothing had happened. Bonaparte's empire had not foundered, and Bonaparte himself had ridden into battle as coolly as ever. And so eventually Mr. Norrell was instructed to leave off. Privately, Sir Walter and Mr. Canning thought that the plan had failed because Mr. Norrell had no talent for creating horrors. Mr. Canning complained that the nightmares Mr. Norrell had sent the Emperor, which concerned a captain of dragoons hiding in Bonaparte's wardrobe, would scarcely frighten his children's governess, let alone the conqueror of half of Europe. For a while he had tried to persuade the other ministers that they should commission Mr. Beckford, Mr. Lewis, and Mrs. Radcliffe to create dreams of vivid horror that Mr. Norrell could then pop into Bonaparte's head. But the other ministers considered that to employ a magician was one thing, novelists were quite another, and they would not stoop to it. With Strange, the plan was revived. Strange and Mr. Canning suspected that the wicked French emperor was proof against such insubstantial evils as dreams, and so they decided to begin this time with his ally, Alexander, the Emperor of Russia. They had the advantage of a great many friends at Alexander's court, Russian nobles who had made a great deal of money selling timber to Britain and were anxious to do so again, and a brave and ingenious Scottish lady who was the wife of Alexander's valet. On learning that Alexander was a curiously impressionable person, much given to mystical religion, Strange decided to send him a dream of eerie portents and symbols. For 7 nights in succession, Alexander dreamt a dream in which he sat down to a comfortable supper with Napoleon Bonaparte, at which they were served some excellent venison soup. But no sooner had the emperor tasted the soup than he jumped up and cried, "J'ai une femme qui ne saura se satisfaire de potage." Footnote 5. I have a hunger which soup can never satisfy. Whereupon he turned into a she-wolf, which ate first Alexander's cat, then his dog, then his horse, then his pretty Turkish mistress. And as the she-wolf set to work to eat up more of Alexander's friends and relations, her womb opened and disgorged the cat, dog, horse, Turkish mistress, friends, relations, etc. again, but in horrible, misshapen forms. And as she ate, she grew, and when she was big as the Kremlin, she turned, heavy teats swaying and maw all bloody, intent on devouring all of Moscow. There can be nothing dishonourable in sending him a dream which tells him that he is wrong to trust Bonaparte, and that Bonaparte will betray him in the end, explained Strange to Arabella. I might, after all, send him a letter to say as much. He is wrong, and nothing is more certain than that Bonaparte will betray him in the end. Word soon came from the Scottish lady that the Russian emperor had been exceedingly troubled by the dreams, and that, like King Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible, he had sent for astrologers and soothsayers to interpret it for him, which they very soon did. Strange then sent more dreams to the Russian emperor, and, he told Mr. Canning, I have taken your advice and made them more obscure and difficult of interpretation, that the emperor's sorcerers may have something to do. The indefatigable Mrs. Janet Archibaldovna Basukova was soon able to convey the satisfying news that Alexander neglected the business of government and war, and sat all day musing upon his dreams and discussing them with astrologers and sorcerers, and that whenever a letter came for him from the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, he was seen to turn pale and shudder. Chapter 26. Orb, Crown and Scepter. September 1809. Every night, without fail, Lady Pole and Stephen Black were summoned by the sad bell to dance in Lost Hope's shadowy halls. For fashion and beauty, these were, without a doubt, the most splendid balls Stephen had ever seen, but the fine clothes and smart appearance of the dancers made an odd contrast with the mansion itself, which exhibited numerous signs of poverty and decay. The music never varied. The same handful of tunes were scraped out by a single violin and tooted out by a single pipe. The greasy tallow candles, Stephen could not help but observe with his butler's eye how there were far too few of them for such a vast hall, cast up strange shadows that spun across the walls as the dancers went through their figures. On other occasions, Lady Pole and Stephen took part in long processions in which banners were carried through dusty, ill-lit halls, the gentleman with the thistledown hair having a great fondness for such ceremonies. Some of the banners were ancient and decaying pieces of dense embroidery. Others represented the gentleman's victories over his enemies, and were, in fact, made from the preserved skins of those enemies, their lips, eyes, hair, and clothes having been embroidered onto their yellow skins by his female relations. The gentleman with the thistledown hair never grew tired of these pleasures, and he never appeared to entertain the slightest doubt that Stephen and Lady Pole were equally delighted with them. Though changeable in all else, he remained constant in two things: his admiration of her ladyship and his affection for Stephen Black. The latter he continued to demonstrate by making Stephen extravagant gifts and by sending him strange pieces of good fortune. Some of the gifts were made, as before, to Mrs. Brandy on Stephen's behalf, and some were sent directly to Stephen, for, as the gentleman told Stephen cheerfully, "Your wicked enemy will know nothing about it." He meant Sir Walter. "I have very cleverly blinded him with my magic, and it would never occur to him to wonder about it. Why, you could be made Archbishop of Canterbury tomorrow, and he would think nothing of it. No one would." A thought appeared to strike him. "Would you like to be Archbishop of Canterbury tomorrow, Stephen?"
"No, thank you, sir."
"Are you quite certain? It's scarcely any trouble, and if the church has any attraction for you..."
"I promise you, sir, it has none."
"Your good taste, as ever, does you credit. A mitre is a wretchedly uncomfortable sort of thing to wear, and not at all becoming."
Poor Stephen was assailed by miracles.
Every few days, something would occur to profit him in some way. Sometimes the actual value of what he gained was unremarkable, perhaps no more than a few shillings. But the means by which it came to him were always extraordinary. Once, for example, he received a visit from the overseer of a farm who insisted that some years before he had met Stephen at a cockfight near Richmond in the North Riding of Yorkshire, and that Stephen had wagered him that the Prince of Wales would one day do something to bring disgrace upon the country. As this had now happened, the overseer cited the prince's desertion of his wife as the shameful deed. The overseer had come to London by the stagecoach to bring Stephen 27 shillings and sixpence, which he said was the amount of the wager. It was useless for Stephen to insist that he had never been to a cockfight or to Richmond in Yorkshire. The overseer would not be content until Stephen had taken the money. A few days after the overseer's visit, a large grey dog was discovered standing in the road opposite the house in Harley Street. The poor creature was drenched by the rain and splattered with mud, and bore every sign of having travelled a great distance. More curious still, it had a document grasped between its jaws. The footmen, Robert and Geoffrey, and John Longridge, the cook, did their best to get rid of it by shouting and hurling bottles and stones at it. But the dog bore this treatment philosophically and declined to move until Stephen Black had come out in the rain and taken the document from its mouth. Then it went away with a quietly contented air, as if congratulating itself upon a difficult task well done. The document proved to be a map of a village in Derbyshire, and showed, among other surprising things, a secret door let into the side of a hill. Another time, Stephen received a letter from the mayor and alderman of Bath, describing how 2 months before, the Marquess of Wellesley had been in Bath and done nothing during his stay but talk of Stephen Black and his remarkable honesty, intelligence, and faithfulness to his master. So impressed had the mayor and the alderman been by his lordship's report that they had immediately ordered a medal celebrating Stephen's life and virtues to be struck. When 500 medals had been made, the mayor and the alderman had ordered them to be distributed to the chief householders of Bath amid general rejoicing. They enclosed a medal for Stephen, and begged that whenever he next found himself in Bath, he would make himself known to them, so that they might hold a magnificent dinner in his honour. None of these miracles did anything to raise poor Stephen's spirits. They only served to emphasise the eerie character of his present life. He knew that the overseer, dog, and the mayor and alderman were all acting against their natures. Overseers loved money. They did not give it away for no good reason. Dogs did not patiently pursue strange quests for weeks on end, and mayors and aldermen did not suddenly develop a lively interest in negro servants they had never seen. Yet none of his friends seemed to think there was anything remarkable about the course his life was taking. He was sick of the sight of gold and silver, and his little room at the top of the house in Harley Street was full of treasures he did not want. He had been almost 2 years under the gentleman's enchantment. He had often pleaded with the gentleman to release him, or if not him, then Lady Pole. But the gentleman would not hear of it. So Stephen had roused himself to try and tell someone about what he and Lady Pole suffered. He was anxious to discover if there were any precedents for their case. He had faint hopes of finding someone who would free them. The first person he had spoken to was Robert, the footman. He had warned Robert that he was about to hear a private revelation of a secret woe, and Robert had looked suitably solemn and interested. But when Stephen began to speak, he found to his own astonishment that it was upon quite a different matter. He found himself delivering a very earnest and learned discourse upon the cultivation and uses of peas and beans, a subject he knew nothing about. Worse still, some of his information was of a most unusual nature, and would have frankly astonished any farmer or gardener who heard it. He explained the different properties of beans, either planted or gathered, by moonlight, by moon dark, at Beltane, or on Midsummer's night, and how these properties were changed if you sowed or gathered the beans with a silver trowel or knife. The next person to whom he attempted to describe his trouble was John Longridge. This time, he found himself delivering an exact account of Julius Caesar's dealings and experiences in Britain. It was clearer and more detailed than any scholar could have managed, though he had studied the subject for 20 years or more. Once again, it contained information that was not set down in any book. Footnote 1. Stephen described how not long after Julius Caesar had arrived upon these shores, he had left his army and wandered into a little green wood. He had not gone far when he came upon two young men sighing deeply and striking the ground in their frustration. Both were remarkably handsome, and both were dressed in the finest linens dyed with the rarest dyes. Julius Caesar was so struck with the noble appearance of these young men that he asked them all sorts of questions, and they answered him candidly and without the least diffidence. They explained how they were both plaintiffs at a court nearby. The court was held every quarter day to settle arguments and punish wrongdoers among their people, but unfortunately, the race to which they belonged was a peculiarly wicked and quarrelsome one, and just at present no suits could be heard because they could not find an impartial judge. Every venerable person among them either stood accused of a crime or else had been found to have some other close connection with one of the suits. On hearing this, Caesar was struck with pity for them and immediately offered to be their judge himself, to which they eagerly agreed. They led him a short way through the wood to a grassy hollow between smooth green hills. Here, he found 1,000 or so of the handsomest men and women that he had ever seen. He sat down upon the hillside and heard all their complaints and accusations. And when he heard them, he gave judgments so wise that everyone was delighted, and no one went away feeling himself ill-used. So pleased were they with Julius Caesar's judgments that they offered him anything he liked as payment. Julius Caesar thought for a moment and said that he would like to rule the world. This they promised him. He made 2 more attempts to communicate his horrible situation. To Mrs. Brandy, he delivered an odd defense of Judas Iscariot, in which he declared that in all Iscariot's last actions, he was following the instructions of 2 men called John Copperhead and John Brassfoot, whom Iscariot had believed to be angels. And to Toby Smith, Mrs. Brandy's shopman, he gave a list of all the people in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England who had ever been stolen away by fairies in the last 200 years. None of them were people he had ever heard of. Stephen was obliged to conclude that, try as he might, he could not speak of his enchantment. The person who suffered most from his strange silences and dismal spirits was, without a doubt, Mrs. Brandy. She did not understand that he had changed to the whole world. She only saw that he had changed towards her. One day, at the beginning of September, Stephen paid her a visit. They had not met for some weeks, which had made Mrs. Brandy so unhappy that she had written to Robert Austin, and Robert had gone to Stephen and scolded him for his neglect. However, once Stephen had arrived in the little parlour above the shop in St. James's Street, no one could have blamed Mrs. Brandy if she had wished him immediately away again. He sat with his head in his hand, sighing heavily, and had nothing to say to her. She offered him Constantia wine, marmalade, an old-fashioned Whig bun, all sorts of delicacies. But he refused them all. He wanted nothing. And so she sat down on the opposite side of the fire and resumed her needlework, a nightcap which she was despondently embroidering for him.
"Perhaps," she said, "you are tired of London, and of me, and you wish to return to Africa."
"No," said Stephen.
"I dare say Africa is a remarkably charming place," said Mrs. Brandy,
who seemed determined to punish herself by sending Stephen immediately to Africa.
"I've always heard that it is, with oranges and pineapples everywhere one looks, and sugar canes and chocolate trees."
She had laboured 14 years in the grocery trade and had mapped out her world in its stock. She laughed bitterly.
"It seems that I would fare very ill in Africa. What need have people of shops when they only have to stretch out their hand and pluck the fruit of the nearest tree? Oh, yes, I shall be ruined in no time in Africa."
She snapped a thread between her teeth.
"Not that I should not be glad to go tomorrow."
She poked the thread viciously into the needle's innocent eye.
"If anyone were to ask me."
"Would you go to Africa for my sake?" asked Stephen in surprise. She looked up.
"I would go anywhere for your sake," she said. "I thought you knew that."
They regarded one another unhappily. Stephen said that he must return and attend to his duties in Harley Street. Outside in the street, the sky darkened and rain began to fall. People put up umbrellas. As Stephen walked up St. James's Street, he saw a strange sight. A black ship sailing towards him through the grey, rainy air above the heads of the crowd.
It was a frigate, some 2 feet high, with dirty, ragged sails and peeling paint. It rose and fell, mimicking the motions of ships at sea. Stephen shivered a little to see it. A beggar emerged from the crowd, a negro with skin as dark and shining as Stephen's own. Fastened to his hat was this ship, and as he walked, he ducked and raised his head so that the ship could sail. As he went, he performed his curious bobbing and swaying movements very slowly and carefully, for fear of upsetting his enormous hat. The effect was of a man dancing amazingly slowly. The beggar's name was Johnson. He was a poor, crippled sailor who'd been denied a pension. Having no other means of relief, he had taken to singing and begging to make a livelihood, in which he had been most successful, and he was known throughout the town for the curious hat he wore. Johnson held out his hand to Stephen, but Stephen looked away. He always took great care not to speak to or in any way acknowledge negroes of low station. He feared that if he were seen speaking to such people, it might be supposed that he had some connection with them. He heard his name cried out, and he jumped as if he'd been scalded. But it was only Toby Smith, Mrs. Brandy's shopman.
"Oh, Mr. Black," cried Toby, hurrying up. "There you are. You generally walk so fast, sir. I was sure you would be in Harley Street by now. Mrs. Brandy sends her compliments, sir, and says you left this by your chair."
Toby held out a silver diadem, a delicate band of metal of a size to fit Stephen's head exactly. It had no ornament other than a few odd signs and queer letters cut into its surface. "But this is not mine," said Stephen.
"Oh,"
said Toby blankly. But then he appeared to decide that Stephen was joking.
"Oh, Mr. Black, as if I have not seen it upon your head 100 times.
Then he laughed and bowed and ran back to the shop, leaving Stephen with the diadem in his hand. He crossed over Piccadilly into Bond Street. He had not gone far when he heard shouting, and a tiny figure came running down the street. In stature, the figure appeared no more than 4 or 5 years old, but its dead white, sharp-featured face belonged to a much older child. It was followed at a distance by 2 or 3 men shouting, "Thief!" and "Stop him!" Stephen sprang into the thief's path. Though the young thief could not entirely escape Stephen, who was nimble, Stephen was not quite able to fasten onto the thief, who was slippery. The thief held a long bundle wrapped in a red cloth, which he somehow contrived to tip into Stephen's hands before darting in among a crowd of people outside Hemmings the goldsmith. These people were but newly emerged from Hemmings and knew nothing of the pursuit, so they did not spring apart when the thief arrived among them. It was impossible to say which way he went. Stephen stood holding the bundle. The cloth, which was a soft old velvet, slipped away, revealing a long rod of silver. The first of the pursuers to arrive was a dark, handsome gentleman, somberly but elegantly dressed in black.
"You had him for a moment," he said to Stephen.
"I am only sorry, sir," said Stephen, "that I could not hold him for you. But as you see, I have your property."
Stephen offered the man the rod of silver and the red velvet cloth, but the man did not take them.
"It was my mother's fault," said the gentleman angrily. "Oh, how could she be so negligent? I've told her 1,000 times that if she left the drawing-room window open, sooner or later a thief would come in by it. Have I not said so 100 times, Edward? Have I not said so, John?"
The latter part of this speech was addressed to the gentleman's servants, who had come running up after their master. They lacked breath to reply, but were able to assure Stephen by emphatic nods that the gentleman had indeed said so.
"All the world knows that I keep many treasures at my house," continued the gentleman, "and yet she continues to open the window in spite of my entreaties. And now, of course, she sits weeping for the loss of this treasure, which has been in my family for hundreds of years. For my mother takes great pride in our family and all its possessions. This scepter, for example, is proof that we are descended from the ancient kings of Wessex, for it belonged to Edgar or Alfred or someone of that sort."
"Then you must take it back, sir," urged Stephen. "Your mother, I dare say, will be much relieved to see it safe and sound." The gentleman reached out to take the scepter, but suddenly drew back his hand.
"No," he cried. "I will not. I vow I will not. If I were to return this treasure to my mother's keeping, then she would never learn the evil consequences of her negligence. She would never learn to keep the window shut, and who knows what I might lose next. Why, I might come home tomorrow to an empty house. No, sir, you must keep the scepter. It is a reward for the service you did me in trying to catch hold of the thief.
The gentlemen's servants all nodded, as if they saw the sense of this. Then a coach drew up, and gentlemen and servants all got into it and drove away. Stephen stood in the rain, with a diadem in one hand and a scepter in the other. Ahead of him were the shops of Bond Street, the most fashionable shops in all the kingdom. In their windows were displayed silks and velvets, headdresses of pearl and peacock feathers, diamonds, rubies, jewels, and every sort of gold and silver trinkets. Well, thought Stephen, doubtless he will be able to make all sorts of eerie treasures for me out of the contents of those shops, but I shall be cleverer than him. I shall go home by another way. He turned into a narrow alleyway between two buildings, crossed a little yard, passed through a gate, down another alleyway, and emerged in a little street of modest houses. It was quite deserted here, and strangely quiet. The only sound was the rain striking the cobblestones. Rain had darkened all the fronts of the houses until they appeared to be almost black. The occupants of the houses seemed a very frugal lot, for not one of them had lit a lamp or candle, despite the gloominess of the day. Yet the heavy cloud did not cover the sky completely, and a watery white light showed at the horizon, so that between the dark sky and the dark earth, the rain fell in bright silver shafts. A shining something rolled suddenly out of a dark alleyway and skittered unevenly over the wet cobblestones, coming to a stop directly in front of Stephen. He looked at it, and heaved a great sigh when he saw that it was, as he expected, a little silver ball. It was very battered and old-looking. At the top, where there ought to have been a cross to signify that all the world belonged to God, there was a tiny, open hand. One of the fingers was broken off. This symbol, the open hand, was one that Stephen knew well. It was one of those employed by the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. Only last night Stephen had taken part in a procession and carried a banner bearing this very emblem through dark, windswept courtyards and along avenues of immense oak trees in whose unseen branches the wind soughed. There was the sound of a window sash being raised. A woman poked her head out of a window at the top of the house. Her hair was all in curl papers.
"Well, pick it up," she cried, glaring furiously at Stephen.
"But it's not mine," he called up to her.
"It is not his," he says.
This made her angrier still.
"And I suppose I did not just see it fall out of your pocket and roll away? And I suppose my name is not Maria Tompkins? And I suppose I do not labour night and day to keep Pepper Street clean and tidy, but you must come here a purpose to throw away your rubbish?"
With a heavy sigh, Stephen picked up the orb. He found that whatever Maria Tompkins said or believed, if he put it in his pocket, there was a very real danger of it tearing the cloth, it was so heavy. So he was obliged to walk through the rain, scepter in one hand, orb in the other. The diadem he put on his head, as the most convenient place for it, and attired in this fashion, he walked home. On arriving at the house in Harley Street, he went down to the area and opened the kitchen door. He found himself not in the kitchen, as he had expected, but in a room he had never seen before. He sneezed 3 times. A moment was enough to reassure him that he was not at Lost Hope. It was quite a commonplace sort of room, the sort of room, in fact, that one might find in any well-to-do house in London. It was, however, remarkably untidy. The inhabitants, who were presumably new to the house, appeared to be in the middle of unpacking. All the articles usually belonging to a sitting room and study were present. Card tables, work tables, reading tables, fire irons, chairs of varying degrees of comfortableness and usefulness, mirrors, teacups, sealing wax, candlesticks, pictures, books, a great number of these, sanders, inkstands, pens, papers, clocks, balls of string, footstools, fire screens, and writing desks. But they were all jumbled together and standing upon one another in new and surprising combinations. Packing cases and boxes and bundles were scattered about, some unpacked, some half unpacked, and some scarcely begun. The straw from the packing cases had been pulled out and now lay scattered about the room and over the furniture, which had the effect of making everything dusty and causing Stephen to sneeze 2 times more. Some of the straw had even gotten into the fireplace,
so that there was a very real danger of the whole room going up in a conflagration at any moment. The room contained two people, a man whom Stephen had never seen before, and the gentleman with the thistledown hair. The man he had never seen before was seated at a little table in front of the window. Presumably, he ought to have been unpacking his things and setting his room in order, but he had abandoned this task and was presently engaged in reading a book. He broke off every now and then to look things up in two or three other volumes that lay on the table, to mutter excitedly to himself, and to dash down a note or two in an ink-splashed little book. Meanwhile, the gentleman with the thistledown hair sat in an armchair on the opposite side of the fireplace, directing at the other man a look of such extreme malevolence and irritation as made Stephen fear for the man's life. Yet the moment the gentleman with the thistledown hair beheld Stephen, he became all delight, all affability.
"Ah, there you are," he cried. "How noble you look in your kingly accoutrements."
There appeared to be a large mirror standing opposite the door. For the first time, Stephen saw himself with the crown, scepter, and orb. He looked every inch a king. He turned to look at the man at the table to discover how he bore with the sudden appearance of a black man in a crown.
"Oh, do not concern yourself about him," said the gentleman with the thistledown hair. "He can neither see nor hear us. He has no more talent than the other one. Look."
He screwed up a piece of paper and threw it energetically at the man's head. The man did not flinch or look up or appear to know anything about it.
"The other one, sir," said Stephen. "What do you mean?"
"That is the younger magician, the one lately arrived in London."
"Is it indeed? I have heard of him, of course. Sir Walter thinks highly of him. But I confess I have forgotten his name."
"Oh, who cares what his name is? What matters is that he is just as stupid as the other one, and very near as ugly."
"What?" said the magician suddenly. He turned away from his book and looked around the room with a slightly suspicious air.
"Jeremy!"
he called out very loudly. A servant put his head around the door, but did not trouble himself so far as to come into the room.
"Sir?" he said.
Stephen's eyes opened very wide at this lazy behaviour. It was a thing he would never have allowed in Harley Street. He made a point of staring very coldly at the man to show him what he thought of him, before he remembered that the man could not see him. "These London houses are shockingly built," said the magician. "I can hear the people in the next house." This was interesting enough to tempt the servant, called Jeremy, all the way into the room. He stood and listened.
"Are the walls so thin?" continued the magician. "Do you suppose there can be something wrong with them?"
Jeremy knocked on the wall which divided the house from its neighbour. It responded with as dull and quiet a sound as any stout, well-built wall in the kingdom. Making nothing of this, he said,
"I do not hear anything, sir. What were they saying?"
"I believe I heard one of them call the other stupid and ugly."
"Are you sure, sir? It's two old ladies that live upon that side."
"That proves nothing. Age is no guarantee of anything these days." With this remark, the magician appeared suddenly to grow tired of this conversation. He turned back to his book and started reading. Jeremy waited a moment, and then, since his master appeared to have forgotten all about him, he went away again.
"I have not thanked you yet, sir," said Stephen to the gentleman, "for these wonderful gifts."
"Ah, Stephen, I'm glad to have pleased you. The diadem, I confess, is your own hat, transformed by magic. I would have greatly preferred to give you a real crown, but I was entirely unable to lay my hand upon one at such short notice. You are disappointed, I dare say. Although now I come to think of it, the King of England has several crowns, and rarely makes use of any of them."
He raised his hands in the air and pointed upwards with two immensely long white fingers.
"Oh," cried Stephen, suddenly realizing what the gentleman was about. "If you think of casting spells to bring the King of England here with one of his crowns, which I imagine you do, since you are all kindness, then I beg that you will spare yourself the trouble. I have no need of one at the moment, as you know, and the King of England is such an old gentleman. Would it not perhaps be kinder to let him stay at home?"
"Well, very well," said the gentleman, lowering his hands.
For lack of any other occupation, he resumed his abuse of the new magician. Nothing about the man pleased him. He ridiculed the book he was reading, found fault with the make of his boots, and was entirely unable to approve of his height, despite the fact that he was exactly the same height as the gentleman with the thistledown hair, as was proved when they both happened to stand up at the same time. Stephen was anxious to return to his duties in Harley Street, but he feared that if he left them alone together, then the gentleman might start throwing something more substantial than paper at the magician. "Shall you and I walk to Harley Street together, sir?" he asked. "Then you may tell me how your noble actions have moulded London and made it glorious. That is always so very entertaining. I never grow tired of hearing about it."
"Oh, gladly, Stephen, gladly."
"Is it far, sir?"
"Is what far, Stephen?"
"Harley Street, sir. I do not know where we are."
"We are in Soho Square, and no, it is not far at all."
When they reached the house in Harley Street, the gentleman took a most affectionate farewell of Stephen, urging him not to feel sad at this parting, and reminding him that they would meet again that very night at Lost Hope.
"When a most charming ceremony will be held in the belfry of the easternmost tower. It commemorates an occasion which happened, 500 years ago or so, when I cleverly contrived to capture the little children of my enemy, and we pushed them out of the belfry to their deaths. Tonight we will reenact this great triumph. We will dress straw dolls in the children's blood-stained clothes and fling them down onto the paving stones, and then we will sing and dance and rejoice over their destruction."
"And do you perform this ceremony every year, sir? I feel sure I would have remembered it if I had seen it before. It is so very striking."
"I'm glad you think so. I perform it whenever I think of it. Of course, it was a great deal more striking when we used real children."
Chapter 27. The Magician's Wife. December 1809 to January 1810. There were now two magicians in London to be admired and made much of, and I doubt if it will come as much surprise to anyone to learn that, of the two, London preferred Mr. Strange. Strange was everyone's idea of what a magician ought to be. He was tall, he was charming, he had a most ironical smile, and unlike Mr. Norrell, he talked a great deal about magic and had no objection to answering anybody's questions on the subject. Mr. and Mrs. Strange attended a great many evening and dinner parties, and at some point in the proceedings, Strange would generally oblige the company with a show of one of the minor sorts of magic. The most popular magic he did was to cause visions to appear upon the surface of water. Footnote 1. On May 14th, 1810, Strange wrote to John Segundus, "There is a great passion here for seeing visions, which I am always glad to satisfy whenever I can. Whatever Norrell may say, it's very little trouble, and nothing delights the layman so much. My only complaint is that people always end by asking me to show them their relations. I was in Tavistock Square on Tuesday, at the house of a family called Fulcher. I spilled some wine upon the table, did the magic, and showed them a sea battle, which was at that moment raging in the Bahamas, a view of a ruined Neapolitan monastery by moonlight, and finally, the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte drinking a cup of chocolate, with his feet in a steaming bowl of water. The Fulchers were well-bred enough to seem interested in what I was doing, but at the end of the evening, they asked me if I might be able to show them their aunt, who lives in Carlisle. For the next half hour, Arabella and I were obliged to converse with each other while the family stared enraptured at the spectacle of an old lady seated by the fire in a white cap knitting. Letters and Miscellaneous Papers of Jonathan Strange, Editor John Segundus, Publisher John Murray, London, 1824. Unlike Norrell, he did not use a silver basin, which was the traditional vessel for seeing visions in. Strange said that really one could see so little in a basin that it was scarcely worth the trouble of casting the spells. He preferred instead to wait until the servants had cleared the dishes off the table and removed the cloth. Then he would tip a glass of water or wine over the table and conjure visions into the pool. Fortunately, his hosts were generally so delighted with the magic that they hardly ever complained of their stained, spoilt tables and carpets. For their part, Mr. and Mrs. Strange were settled in London much to their satisfaction. They had taken a house in Soho Square, and Arabella was deep in all the pleasant cares connected with a new home, commissioning elegant new furniture from the cabinet makers,
entreating her friends to help her to some steady servants, and going every day to the shops. One morning in mid-December, she received a message from one of the shopmen at Hague and Chippendale's upholstery, a most attentive person, to say that a bronze silk with alternate satin and watered stripes had just arrived in the shop, and he believed it might be the very thing for Mrs. Strange's drawing-room curtains. This necessitated a little reorganization of Arabella's day. "It appears from Mr. Sumner's description to be very elegant," she told Strange at breakfast, "and I expect to like it very much. But if I choose bronze-colored silk for the curtains, then I believe I must give up any notion of having a wine-colored velvet for the chaise longue. I do not think bronze color and wine color will look well together. So I shall go to Flint and Clark's to look at the wine-colored velvet again, and see if I can bear to give it up. Then I will go to Hague and Chippendale's. But that means I will have no time to visit your aunt, which I really ought to do, as she's leaving for Edinburgh this morning. I want to thank her for finding Mary for us."
"Hmm," said Strange, who was eating hot rolls and preserves and reading Curious Observations upon the Anatomy of Fairies by Holgarth and Pickle. Footnote 2. One of Mr. Norrell's books. Mr. Norrell mentioned it somewhat obliquely when Mr. Segundus and Mr. Honeyfoot waited upon him in early January 1807.
"Mary, the new maid, you saw her last night."
"Ah," said Strange, turning a page.
"She seems a nice, pleasant girl with quiet ways. I'm sure we will be very happy with her. So, as I was saying, I would be very grateful, Jonathan, if you would call upon your aunt this morning. You can walk down to Henrietta Street after breakfast and thank her for Mary. Then you can come to Hague and Chippendale's and wait for me there. Oh, and could you look in at Wedgwood and Brierley's and ask the people when the new dinner service will be ready? It will be scarcely any trouble. It's very nearly on your way." She looked at him doubtfully. "Jonathan, are you listening to me?"
"Hmm?" said Strange, looking up.
"Oh, entirely."
So Arabella, attended by one of the footmen, walked to Wigmore Street, where Flint and Clark had their establishment. But on this second viewing of the wine-colored velvet, she concluded that, though very handsome, it was altogether too somber. So then she walked on, all anticipation, to St. Martin's Lane to behold the bronze-colored silk. When she arrived at Hague and Chippendale's, she found the shopman waiting for her, but not her husband. The shopman was most apologetic, but Mr. Strange had not been there all morning. She went out into the street again. "George, do you see your master anywhere?" she asked the footman.
"No, madam."
A grey rain was beginning to fall. A sort of premonition inspired her to look in at the window of a bookseller's. There she discovered Strange talking energetically to Sir Walter Pole. So she went into the shop, bid Sir Walter good morning, and sweetly inquired of her husband if he had visited his aunt or looked in at Wedgwood and Byerly's. Strange seemed somewhat perplexed by the question. He looked down and discovered that he had a large book in his hand. He frowned at it as if he could not imagine how it got there.
"I would have done so, my love, of course," he said, "only Sir Walter has been talking to me all this while, which has quite prevented me from beginning." "It has been entirely my fault," Sir Walter hastily assured Arabella. "We have a problem with our blockade. It's the usual sort of thing, and I've been telling Mr. Strange about it in the hope that he and Mr. Norrell will be able to help us."
"And can you help?" asked Arabella.
"Oh, I should think so," said Strange.
Sir Walter explained that the British government had received intelligence that some French ships, possibly as many as 10, had slipped through the British blockade. No one knew where they'd gone or what they intended to do when they got there. Nor did the government know where to find Admiral Armingcroft, who was supposed to prevent this sort of thing happening. The Admiral and his fleet of 10 frigates and 2 ships of the line had quite disappeared. Presumably, he had gone in pursuit of the French. There was a promising young captain presently stationed at Madeira, and if the Admiralty had only been able to discover what was happening and where it was happening, they would have gladly put Captain Lightwood in charge of 4 or 5 more ships and sent him there. Lord Mulgrave had asked Admiral Greenwax what he thought they ought to do, and Admiral Greenwax had asked the ministers, and the ministers said that the Admiralty ought to consult Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell immediately.
"I would not have you to think that the Admiralty is entirely helpless without Mr. Strange," smiled Sir Walter. "They have done what they can,
They sent one of the clerks, a Mr. Petrofax, to Greenwich, to seek out a childhood friend of Admiral Armingcroft's, to ask him, with his superior knowledge of the Admiral's character, what he thought the Admiral would do under such circumstances. But when Mr. Petrofax got to Greenwich, the Admiral's childhood friend was drunk in bed, and Mr. Petrofax was not sure that he understood the question.
I dare say Norrell and I will be able to suggest something, said Strange thoughtfully. But I think I should like to see the problem on a map.
I have all the necessary maps and papers at my house. One of my servants will bring them to Hanover Square later today, and then perhaps you will be so kind as to talk to Norrell.
Oh, but we can do that now, said Strange. Arabella does not mind waiting a few moments. You do not mind, do you? He said to his wife. I'm meeting Mr. Norrell at 2 o'clock, and I believe that if I can explain the problem to him straight away, then we may be able to return an answer to the Admiralty before dinner. Arabella, like a sweet, compliant woman and a good wife, put all thoughts of her new curtains aside for the moment, and assured both gentlemen that in such a cause it was no trouble to her to wait. It was settled that Mr. and Mrs. Strange would accompany Sir Walter to his house in Harley Street. Strange took out his watch and looked at it. 20 minutes to Harley Street, 3/4 of an hour to examine the problem, then another 15 minutes to Soho Square. Yes, there's plenty of time. Arabella laughed. He is not always so scrupulous, I assure you, she said to Sir Walter. But he was late on Tuesday for an appointment with Lord Liverpool, and Mr. Norrell was not best pleased.
Oh, that was not my fault, said Strange.
I was ready to leave the house in good time, but I could not find my gloves. Arabella's teasing accusation of lateness continued to vex him, and on the way to Harley Street, he examined his watch as though in hopes of discovering something about the operation of time which had hitherto gone unnoticed, and which would vindicate him. When they reached Harley Street, he thought he had it.
Ha! He cried suddenly. I know what it is. My watch is wrong. I do not think so, said Sir Walter, taking out his own watch and showing it to Mr. Strange. It is precisely noon. Mine says the same.
Then why do I hear no bells? Said Strange.
Do you hear bells? He said to Arabella.
No, I hear nothing. Sir Walter reddened and muttered something about the bells in this parish and the neighbouring ones being no longer rung.
Really? Asked Strange. Why in the world not?
Sir Walter looked as though he would have thanked Strange to keep his curiosity to himself, but all he said was,
Lady Pearl's illness has left her nerves in a sad condition. The tolling of a bell is peculiarly distressing to her, and I have asked the vestries of St. Marylebone and St. Peter if they would, out of consideration for Lady Pearl's nerves, forbear from ringing the church bells, and they have been so obliging as to agree.
This was rather extraordinary. But then it was generally agreed that Lady Pearl's illness was a rather extraordinary thing with symptoms quite unlike any other. Neither Mr. or Mrs. Strange had ever seen Lady Pearl. No one had seen her for 2 years. When they arrived at number 9 Harley Street, Strange was anxious to begin looking at Sir Walter's documents straight away, but he was obliged to curb his impatience while Sir Walter satisfied himself that Arabella would not lack for amusement in their absence. Sir Walter was a well-bred man and greatly disliked leaving any guest alone in his house. To abandon a lady was particularly bad. Strange, on the other hand, was anxious to be on time for his appointment with Mr. Norrell. So as fast as Sir Walter could suggest diversions, Strange was endeavouring to prove that Arabella needed none of them. Sir Walter showed Arabella the novels in the bookcase and recommended Mrs. Edgeworth's Belinda in particular as being likely to amuse her.
Oh, said Strange, interrupting, I read Belinda to Arabella 2 or 3 years ago. Besides, you know, I do not think we will be so long that she will have time to finish a 3-volume novel. Then perhaps some tea and seed cake, Sir Walter said to Arabella.
But Arabella does not care for seed cake, interrupted Strange, absent-mindedly picking up Belinda himself and beginning to read the 1st volume. It is a thing she particularly dislikes.
A glass of Madeira, then? Said Sir Walter. You will take some Madeira, I'm sure. Stephen, fetch Mrs. Strange a glass of Madeira.
In the eerie, silent fashion peculiar to high-trained London servants, a tall black servant appeared at Sir Walter's elbow. Mr. Strange seemed quite startled by his sudden arrival and stared hard at him for several moments before he said to his wife,
You do not want Madeira, do you? You do not want anything?
No, Jonathan,
I do not want anything, agreed his wife, laughing at their odd argument. Thank you, Sir Walter, but I am perfectly content to sit here quietly and read.
The black servant bowed and departed as silently as he had come, and Strange and Sir Walter went off to talk of the French fleet and the missing English ships. But when she was left alone, Arabella found that she was not, after all, in the mood for reading. On looking round the room in search of amusement, her eye was caught by a large painting. It was a landscape comprising woods and a ruined castle perched on top of a cliff. The trees were dark, and the ruins and the cliff were touched with gold by the light of a setting sun. The sky, by contrast, was full of light and glowed with pearly colour. A large portion of the foreground was occupied by a silvery pool in which a young woman appeared to be drowning. A second figure bent over her, whether man, woman, satyr, or faun, it was impossible to determine, and though Arabella studied their postures carefully, she could not decide whether it was the intention of the second figure to save the young woman or murder her. When she had tired of looking at this painting, Arabella wandered out into the passage to look at the pictures there. But as these were for the most part watercolour views of Brighton and Chelmsford, she found them very dull. Sir Walter and Strange could be heard talking in another room.
"Extraordinary thing, yet he is an excellent fellow in his way," said Sir Walter's voice.
"Oh, I know who you mean. He has a brother who is an organist at Bath Cathedral," said Strange. "He has a black and white cat that walks about the Bath streets just ahead of him. Once, when I was in Milsom Street..."
A door stood open, through which Arabella could see a very elegant drawing room, with a great number of paintings that appeared to be more splendid and richly coloured than anything she had yet seen. She went in. The room seemed to be full of light, although the day was every bit as grey and forbidding as it had been before.
"So where does all this light come from?" wondered Arabella.
"It is almost as if it shines out of the paintings, but that is impossible." The paintings were all of Venice. Footnote 3. These were Venetian paintings, which Mr. Norrell had seen at Mrs. Wintertown's house 2 years before. Mrs. Wintertown had informed Mr. Norrell at the time that she intended to give them to Sir Walter and Miss Wintertown as a wedding present. And certainly the great quantities of sky and sea which they contained made the room seem somehow insubstantial. When she had done examining the paintings upon one wall, she turned to cross to the opposite wall and immediately discovered, much to her mortification, that she was not alone. A young woman was sitting before the fire on a blue sofa, regarding her with some curiosity. The sofa had a rather high back, which was the reason Arabella had not observed her before.
"Oh, I do beg your pardon."
The young woman said nothing. She was a remarkably elegant woman, with a pale, perfect skin and dark hair most gracefully arranged. She wore a gown of white muslin and an Indian shawl of ivory, silver, and black. She seemed altogether too well dressed to be a governess, and too much at home to be a lady's companion. Yet, if she were a guest in the house, why had Sir Walter not introduced her? Arabella curtsied to the young woman, and blushing slightly said,
"I thought there was no one here. I beg your pardon for intruding upon you."
She turned to leave.
"Oh," said the young woman, "I hope you do not think of going. I so rarely see anyone, scarcely anyone at all. And besides, you wish to see the paintings. You cannot deny it, you know, for I saw you in that mirror as you entered the room, and your intention was plain."
A large Venetian mirror hung above the fireplace. It had a most elaborate frame, which was also made of mirror glass, and it was decorated with the ugliest glass flowers and scrolls imaginable.
"I hope," said the young woman, "that you will not allow me to prevent you."
"But I fear I disturb you," said Arabella.
"Oh, but you do not."
The young woman gestured towards the paintings.
"Pray, continue."
So feeling it would be a still worse breach of manners to refuse, Arabella thanked the young woman and went and examined the other paintings. But she did it less minutely than before, because she was conscious that the young woman watched her in the mirror the entire time. When she had finished, the young woman asked Arabella to sit.
"And how do they please you?" she asked.
"Well," said Arabella, "they are certainly very beautiful. I particularly like the pictures of processions and feasts. We have nothing like them in England. So many fluttering banners,
so many gilded boats and exquisite costumes. But it seems to me that the artist loves buildings and blue skies more than people. He has made them so small, so insignificant. Among so many marble palaces and bridges, they seem almost lost. Do you not think so? This seemed to amuse the young woman. She smiled a wry smile.
Lost, she said. Oh, I should think they are indeed lost, poor souls. For when all is said and done, Venice is only a labyrinth, a vast and beautiful labyrinth, to be sure, but a labyrinth nonetheless, and none but its oldest inhabitants can be sure of finding their way about. Or at least, that is my understanding.
Indeed, said Arabella. That must certainly be very inconvenient. But then the sensation of being lost in a labyrinth must be so delightful. Oh, I believe I should give almost anything to go there. The young woman regarded her with an odd, melancholy smile.
If you had spent months, as I have done, wearily parading through endless dark passageways, you would think very differently. The pleasures of losing oneself in a maze pall very quickly. And as for curious ceremonies, processions, and feasts, well, she shrugged, I quite detest them.
Arabella did not very well comprehend her, but thought it might help it if she discovered who the young woman was, and so she inquired as to her name.
I am Lady Pole.
Oh, of course, said Arabella, and wondered why she had not thought of this before. She told Lady Pole her own name, and that her husband had business with Sir Walter, which was the reason of her being there. A sudden burst of loud laughter was heard from the direction of the library. They're supposed to be talking of the war, Arabella observed to her ladyship. But either the war has got a great deal more entertaining recently, or else, as I suspect, they have left business far behind and have got to gossiping about their acquaintance. Half an hour ago, Mr. Strange could think of nothing but his next appointment. But now I suppose Sir Walter has drawn him off to talk of other things, and I dare say he has forgot all about it. She smiled to herself, as wives do when they pretend to criticize their husbands, but are really boasting of them. I really do believe he is the most easily distracted creature in the world. Mr. Norrell's patience must be sorely tried sometimes.
Mr. Norrell, said Lady Pole.
Mr. Strange has the honor to be Mr. Norrell's pupil, said Arabella. She expected her ladyship to reply with some praise for Mr. Norrell's extraordinary magical ability, or some words of gratitude for his kindness. But Lady Pole said nothing, and so Arabella continued in an encouraging tone. Of course, we have heard a great deal of the wonderful magic which Mr. Norrell performed on your ladyship's behalf.
Mr. Norrell has been no friend to me,
said Lady Pole in a dry, matter-of-fact tone.
I had far better be dead than be as I am.
It was such a shocking thing to hear, that for several moments Arabella could think of nothing to say. She had no reason to love Mr. Norrell. He had never done her any kindness. Indeed, he had several times gone out of his way to show her how little he regarded her. But for all that, he was the only other representative of her husband's profession. So, just as the wife of an admiral will always take the part of the navy, or the wife of a bishop will speak up in favor of the church, Arabella felt obliged to say something in defense of the other magician.
Pain and suffering are the very worst of companions, and no doubt your ladyship grows heartily sick of them. No one in the world could blame you for wishing to be rid of them.
Yet even as Arabella spoke these words, she was thinking, it is very odd, but she does not look ill, not in the least.
But if what I hear be true, then your ladyship is not without solace in your suffering. I must confess that I have never heard your ladyship's name spoken without it being accompanied by some praise for your devoted husband. Surely you would not gladly leave him. Surely, your ladyship, you must feel a little grateful to Mr. Norrell, if only for Sir Walter's sake.
Lady Pole did not reply to this. Instead, she began to question Arabella about her husband. How long had he practiced magic? How long had he been Mr. Norrell's pupil? Was his magic generally successful? Did he perform magic by himself, or only under Norrell's direction? Arabella did her best to answer all the questions, adding, if there is anything your ladyship would like me to ask Mr. Strange on your behalf, if there is any service he can do,
Then your ladyship has only to name it. Thank you. But what I have to tell you is as much for your husband's sake as mine. I think Mr. Strange ought to hear how I was left to a horrible fate by Mr. Norrell. Mr. Strange should know what sort of a man he has to deal with. Will you tell him? Of course, I promise me that you will. I will tell Mr. Strange anything your ladyship wishes. I should warn you that I have made many attempts to tell people of my misery, and I have never yet succeeded.
As Lady Pole said this, something happened which Arabella did not quite understand. It was as if something in one of the paintings had moved, or someone had passed behind one of the mirrors, and the conviction came over her once again that this room was no room at all, that the walls had no real solidity, but instead the room were only a sort of crossroads, where strange winds blew upon Lady Pole from faraway places.
In 1607, began Lady Pole, a gentleman named Reedshaw in Halifax, West Yorkshire, inherited £10 from his aunt. He used the money to buy a Turkish carpet, which he then brought home and spread over the stone flags of his parlour. Then he drank some beer and fell asleep in a chair by the fire. He awoke at 2 in the morning to find the carpet covered with 300 or 400 people, each about 2 or 3 inches high. Mr. Reedshaw observed that the most important individuals among them, both men and women, were gorgeously attired in gold and silver armour, and that they rode white rabbits, which were to them as elephants are to us. When he asked what they were doing, the one brave soul among them climbed up to his shoulder and bellowed in his ear that they intended to fight a battle according to the rules of honore bonae, and Mr. Reedshaw's carpet was exactly suited to their purpose, because the regularity of the patterns helped the heralds determine that each army was positioned correctly and took no unfair advantage over the other. However, Mr. Reedshaw did not choose that a battle should be fought upon his new carpet, and so he took a broom and... No, wait. Lady Pole stopped and suddenly covered her face with her hands. That is not what I wish to say.
She began again. This time she told a story of a man who'd gone hunting in a wood. He had become separated from his friends. His horse had caught its hoof in a rabbit hole, and he had tumbled off. As he fell, he had had the strangest impression that he was somehow falling into the rabbit hole. When he picked himself up, he found he was in a strange country lit by its own sun and nurtured by its own rain. In a wood very much like the one he'd just left, he found a mansion where a party of gentlemen, some of them rather odd, were all playing cards together. Lady Pole had just got to the part where the gentleman invited the lost huntsman to join them, when a slight sound, scarcely more than an indrawn breath, made Arabella turn. She discovered that Sir Walter had entered the room and was gazing down at his wife in dismay.
"You are tired," he said to her.
Lady Pole looked up at her husband. Her expression at that moment was curious. There was sadness in it, and pity, too, and oddly enough, a little amusement. It was as if she were saying to herself, "Look at us. What a sad pair we make." Aloud, she said, "I am only tired as I usually am. I must have walked for miles and miles last night, and danced for hours, too."
"Then you must rest," he insisted. "Let me take you upstairs to Pampersford, and she will take care of you."
At first her ladyship seemed inclined to resist. She seized Arabella's hand and held it, as if to show him that she would not consent to be parted from her. But then, just as suddenly, she gave it up and allowed him to lead her away. At the door she turned.
"Goodbye, Mrs. Strange. I hope they will let you come again. I hope you will do me that honour. I see no one, or rather, I see whole roomfuls of people, but not a Christian among them."
Arabella stepped forward, intending to shake Lady Pole's hand and to assure her that she would gladly come again. But Sir Walter had already removed her ladyship from the room. For the second time that day, Arabella was left alone in the house in Harley Street. A bell began to toll. Naturally, she was a little surprised, after all that Sir Walter had said about the Bells of Marylebone standing silent out of deference to Lady Pole's illness. This bell sounded very sad and far away, and it brought before her imagination all sorts of melancholy scenes. Bleak, windswept fens and moors, empty fields with broken walls and gates hanging off their hinges, a black ruined church, an open grave, a suicide buried at a lonely crossroads, a fire of bones blazing in the twilight snow, a gallows with a man swinging from its arm, another man crucified upon a wheel, an ancient spear plunged into the mud with a strange talisman, like a little leather finger hanging from it, a scarecrow whose black rags blew about so violently in the wind that he seemed about to leap into the grey air and fly towards you on vast black wings.
"I must beg your pardon if you have seen anything here to disturb you," said Sir Walter, coming suddenly back into the room.
Arabella caught hold of a chair to steady herself.
"Mrs. Strange, you are not well."
He took hold of her arm and helped her to sit down.
"May I fetch someone? Your husband, her ladyship's maid?"
"No, no," said Arabella, a little out of breath. "I want no one, nothing. I thought, I did not know you were here. That is all." Sir Walter stared at her in great concern. She tried to smile at him, but she was not quite sure that the smile turned out well. He put his hands in his pockets, took them out, ran his fingers through his hair, and sighed deeply.
"I dare say her ladyship has been telling you all sorts of odd tales," he said unhappily.
Arabella nodded.
"And hearing them has distressed you. I'm very sorry for it."
"No, no, not at all. Her ladyship did talk a little of what seemed rather odd, but I did not mind it, not in the least. I felt a little faint, but do not connect the two, I beg you. It was nothing to do with her ladyship. I had a sort of foolish idea that there was a sort of mirror before me with all sorts of strange landscapes in it, and I thought I was falling into it. I suppose I must have been about to faint, and your coming in just then prevented it. But it is very odd. I never did such a thing before."
"Let me fetch Mr. Strange."
Arabella laughed. "You may, if you wish, but I assure you he will be a great deal less concerned about me than you are. Mr. Strange has never been much interested in other people's indispositions. His own are quite another matter. But there is no need to fetch anybody. See, I am myself again. I am perfectly well." There was a little pause. "Lady Pole," began Arabella, and paused, not knowing quite how to continue.
"Her ladyship is generally calm enough," said Sir Walter. "Not exactly at peace, you understand, but calm enough. But on the rare occasions when anyone new comes to the house, it always excites her to these outlandish speeches. I'm sure you are too good to repeat anything of what she has said."
"Oh, of course. I would not repeat it for the world."
"You are very kind."
"And may I come again? Her ladyship seems to wish it very much, and I would be very happy in the acquaintance." Sir Walter took a long moment to consider this proposal. Finally, he nodded. And then he somehow turned his nod into a bow.
"I shall consider that you do us both great honor," he said. "Thank you."
Strange and Arabella left the house in Harley Street, and Strange was in high spirits.
"I see the way to do it," he told her. "Nothing could be simpler. It's a pity I must wait for Norrell's opinion before beginning, or I believe I might solve the entire problem in the next half hour. As I see it, there are two crucial points. The first, whatever is the matter?"
With a little O, Arabella had stopped. It had suddenly occurred to her that she had given two entirely contradictory promises, one to Lady Pole to tell Strange about the gentleman in Yorkshire who had purchased a carpet, and the second to Sir Walter not to repeat anything that Lady Pole had said.
"It is nothing," she said.
"And which of the many occupations that Sir Walter was preparing for you did you fix upon?"
"None of them. I saw Lady Pole, and we had some conversation together. That is all."
"Did you indeed?"
A pity I was not with you. I should have liked to see the woman who owes her life to Norrell's magic. But I have not told you what happened to me. You remember how the Negro servant came in very suddenly? Well, for a moment, I had the distinct impression that there was a tall black king standing there, crowned with a silver diadem and holding a shining silver scepter and an orb. But when I looked again, there was no one there but Sir Walter's Negro servant. Is not that absurd? Strange laughed. Strange had gossiped so long with Sir Walter that he was almost an hour late for his appointment with Mr. Norrell, and Mr. Norrell was very angry. Later the same day, Strange sent a message to the Admiralty to say that Mr. Norrell and he had looked into the problem of the missing French ships, and that they believed they were in the Atlantic, on their way to the West Indies, where they intended to cause some mischief. And furthermore, the two magicians thought that Admiral Armingcroft had guessed correctly what the French were doing and had gone after them. The Admiralty, on the advice of Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell, sent orders to Captain Lightwood to follow the Admiral westwards. In due course, some of the French ships were captured, and those that were not fled back to their French ports and stayed there. Arabella's conscience was sorely racked over the two promises she had made. She put the problem to several matrons, friends of hers in whose good sense and careful judgment she reposed a great deal of confidence. Naturally, she presented it in an ideal form, without naming anyone or mentioning any of the particular circumstances. Unfortunately, this had the effect of making her dilemma entirely incomprehensible, and the wise matrons were unable to help her. It distressed her that she could not confide in Strange, but clearly even to mention it would be to break her word to Sir Walter. After much deliberation, she decided that a promise to a person in their senses ought to be more binding than a promise to someone out of their senses. For after all, what was to be gained by repeating the nonsensical ramblings of a poor madwoman? So she never told Strange what Lady Pole had said. A few days later, Mr. and Mrs. Strange were at a house in Bedford Square, attending a concert of Italian music. Arabella found much to enjoy, but the room where they sat was not quite warm, and so, in a little pause that ensued when a new singer was joining the musicians, she slipped away without any fuss to fetch her shawl from where it lay in another room. She was just wrapping it around herself when there was a whisper of sound behind her, and she looked up to see Drawlight approaching her with the rapidity of a dream and crying out, "Mrs. Strange, how glad I am to see you, and how is dear Lady Pole? I hear that you've seen her." Arabella agreed reluctantly that she had. Drawlight drew her arm through his as a precaution against her running away, and said, "The trouble I have been at to procure an invitation to that house, you would scarcely believe, and none of my efforts have met with the least success. Sir Walter puts me off with one paltry excuse after another. It is always exactly the same. Her ladyship is ill, or she is a little better, but she is never well enough to see anybody."
Well, I suppose, offered Arabella.
Oh, quite, interrupted Drawlight. If she is ill, then of course the rabble must be kept away. But that's no reason for excluding me. I saw her when she was a corpse. Oh, yes. You did not know that, I dare say. On the night he brought her back from the dead, Mr. Norrell came to me and pleaded with me to accompany him to the house. His words were, 'Come with me, my dear Drawlight, for I do not think that my spirits can support the sight of a lady, young, fair and innocent, cut off in the sweetest period of her existence. She stays in the house and sees no one. Some people think that her resurrection has made her proud and unwilling to mix with ordinary mortals. But I think the truth is quite different. I believe that her death and resurrection have bred in her a taste for odd experiences. Do you not think they might? It seems to me entirely possible that she takes something in order to see horrors. I suppose you saw no evidence of anything of that sort. She took no sips from a glass of odd-coloured liquid. There was no folded paper pushed hurriedly into a pocket as you entered the room. A paper such as might contain a teaspoon or two of powder. No? A laudanum generally comes in a little blue glass vial, 2 or 3 inches high. In cases of addiction, the family always believe that they can conceal the truth. But it is quite in vain. It is always found out in the end. He gave an affected laugh. I always find it out. Arabella gently removed her arm from his and begged his pardon.
She was quite unable to supply him with the information he required. She knew nothing of any little bottles or powders. She returned to the concert with much less agreeable feelings than she had taken away. Odious, odious little man.